Today we are talking to Casper, the CTO at Monster Labs, and we discuss ways to create a deeper connection with your customer, what it takes to align culture across a global organization, and why it's never too late to spend more time on the people. All of this right here, right now, on the Modern CTO Podcast.
Here we go!
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
What's up, buddy? How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Where are you calling in from?
So I'm in Copenhagen at the moment. So
yeah,
the headquarters for the EMEA branch is in Copenhagen, also where I live. So
I like Copenhagen. I've been there before.
Amazing. Where you've been?
I came in and then I went across the bridge to Malmo, and I just spent
to Sweden.
Yeah, yeah, it's a cool place. Yeah.
It is. It's a bit cold here in the winter and very dark. It's like it's 6 p.m. now and already dark. And it's going to be light like 8:15 in the morning. So yeah, that's the winter.
So tell me a little bit about the company and what you guys do.
Yeah, so Monster Lab, where I'm group CTO, that's a digital consultancy. We're spread across the entire world, have branches from New York all the way to Tokyo. Tokyo is the headquarter and where they was originally started. And then from like 2012, 13, they started acquiring companies in APAC. And then like in 2016, they acquired the company I used to work in, Notes, which is now the EMEA brains. And then we got a New York office last year. So that's the journey we've been on. And then now we are trying to kind of get everyone together and work under the same umbrella in the future. So that's why, my position is now in the group of everything.
That it's a big company too. You guys work with like Shake Shack, like some really large companies.
Yes, indeed. Especially like in New York brands and like in EMEA and in Tokyo, we have some really big companies we're working for.
And I see like Pokemon on your sales site says you guys did some work with Pokemon. Is that like the game Pokemon?
Yeah, so I think it's not actually Pokemon Go. It's some other like projects within that branch or within that company. But we did a lot of games out of the APAC, the Asian companies. We did a lot of like Unity games over the years.
Do you play a lot of video games?
I used to play a lot of video games. Like when I was at university, I played so much World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I don't really have that much time for it anymore. So I could kind of, when I started doing a lot of programming, when I got out of university, I kind of could see the same engagement as I did with World of Warcraft. I got the same feelings when I did like mobile applications. So I managed to transfer it over to something where I actually got paid for it. So it's a great move.
Right. Like all those hours I've logged on Call of Duty or Halo, like I didn't really get paid for it.
Yeah, exactly. I had a World of Warcraft account with more than 300 days online in the end. That was a full year, full online, right?
Right. That's crazy. Yeah, I remember when they started tracking that, it kind of like, at first I was really excited about it. And then I realized how much the time stacked up when it told me like my total play time inside of Call of Duty. Yeah.
It's not something you should look at. It scares you. If you just like took a entry level job for the same amount of hours, you would be a rich man.
Sometimes I look at screen time on my phone. And it's like, oh, your screen time's up 55% this week. I'm like, because I was watching TED Talks, right? It like makes me feel bad. Like I was doing something educational and that's how my screen time got up. And I'm like, oh, well.
When I'm on vacation, that's when my screen time goes up because I don't have my laptop around. Normally I prefer doing most of them on the laptop instead of the phone. But I don't have that high screen time on my iPhone, actually.
What do you think? You work for a really, innovative company. Like, I'm just curious, you personally, like, what do you think the next thing is? Like, we got all the computing power in our phones, then we have the laptops, and some people are working more from their phones and like less from desktops. But like, if we look 20 years out or something, where do you think we'll be?
So I still think you will have some variation of the phone, but I think it's going to be an interesting race. You have like Apple and Google going both directions there. Where Google is trying to put all the computing power in the cloud and Apple is trying to put everything in the device. It's going to be interesting to see which one of these are actually winning because, of course, it makes sense to have some really thin mobile devices and then put everything in the cloud if the internet connection is good enough for it. why not? So I think that's the one I'm betting on at this point.
You think the cloud?
Yeah, I think that you will have, you don't need that crazy hardware on your phones if you could, if we would just be online all the time and you could like transfer the computing to the cloud and just be like a screen streaming.
That's true, especially with the 5G. And you see all the satellites that like SpaceX and all these companies are putting up into space.
Mm-hmm.
There's like
exactly
that, like tens of thousands. I was watching like Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, they do like podcasts and stuff. And they there's this website called, I think it's like Space Junk or Stuff in Space. And it shows you all the debris and things that are in space. It's ridiculous. Like you can barely see the Earth. And
really?
Yeah. And then they showed like the future launches that they have coming up. I think it was like 28 or 58,000 more satellites between now and 2025. And it just was like astronomers are starting to get upset about it, saying we're not going to be able to see the stars. And so there's some interesting pushback. But what those satellites do is it gives us that ability to, you know, stream down like consistently at a high volume so that we can have that internet anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's amazing that like I'm traveling a lot and like I can go mostly around the world now and not even get built for 4G. It's just in your subscription these days. It's very modern and you're very connected.
I think what happened, you make a good point. I think what happened is those executives like at Verizon, they were traveling and they're like, this is so frustrating. And then through that using of their own product, they just made it easier because it used to be ridiculously difficult to go internationally with your cell phone.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like until lately, it was 12 around 12 US dollars per megabyte when I was in the Middle East. So imagine the bills you get from that if you just roam like you normally do. Yeah.
Watch a quick YouTube video, $500.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Oh man. So what projects are you really excited about?
So like in the entire group, we do like a lot of projects simultaneously, but like from the EMEA branch where I spend most of my time until now, we've been working on some really, really cool projects over the last couple of years. So like, are you familiar with a taxi company called Karim?
No.
So they're operating Middle East. Uber bought them here last year for, I think it was $3 billion, a big acquisition. So we helped them get started with that, like Uber Eats competitor, where we built an entire backend infrastructure and the apps for them. We also have a couple of hotel chains, one of them having the hotels out at Atlantis the Palm in Dubai, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
So that's some really interesting ones. We're getting more into like the pharma business, trying to digitalize around that. And it's a more regulated space. That's very interesting to pick up all that knowledge around that now, but also some really big opportunities and some very, I'll say like you can do some projects which are really touching people in that business, in that area.
Yeah, that's like a big driver, doing work that's meaningful. So when you go around and you're the CTO of Monstar, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
So when you get to go around and talk with these different companies as you're building out their projects, like, how do you connect to the why? Do you meet with them? Like how do you do that?
Yeah, so a normal process where we would like to, like if we could define the process ourselves, then we will be invited in the early stages before there's even a project, while you still talk about the problem, so we can be part of shaping what kind of solution would it take here. Will it be sales solution? Does it even have to be digital? That's the dream scenario, but we also have the other kind of projects where we get in, where they say, so we already figured out that we need this application, we need this website, and then it's more scoped out at this point, right? And then it's about trying to figure out what is the right match, like how do they prefer to work, like depending on companies and especially also around the world, they are operating very differently and at very different speeds. So you need to set up a team which matches that somehow. Also how far they are in digital transformation. Like some of the companies we recently started working with, they are teaching their teams agile at the moment. They used to waterfall until now, right? So of course you need to be in a more teaching position there and also take the team with you. So that's the best situation, to come in that early, be part of shaping all that and figuring out what's the right match. Also, do they need local developer? Do they want nearshore, offshore? how can we set a team which is fitting their expectation and budgets.
So I'm curious, like, you have, you're part of this growing company, it's bigger, it's expanding, but how do you attract, like, continuously attract top talent to you?
That's a good question. Yeah, so when we started the like expanding nodes out to Europe, we started doing that in like 2012. When we opened up in London, we figured out that the, like, the recruitment market was very different in London than it was in Denmark. It was highly run by recruitment agencies controlling all the positions, and you need to use them to kind of attract talent. And what we figured out was, it was one, very costly, and secondly, people were not super loyal when they got placed by a recruiter. The same recruiter would try to place them a new job 1 or 2 years after. So we tried to really turn things around and say, like, why don't we spend that money on making Nodes a really cool place to work for engineering? So we will have the best talent coming to us. And then we came up with this, like, I think we called it hashtag visible, where we want to be out at meetups, speaking at meetups, hosting meetups, attending conferences, speak at conferences, writing a lot of blog posts, contributing to open source, even building our own open source, taking over some abandoned open source projects to kind of keep maintaining them, things like that. So we kind of got our name out a little bit, even though Denmark is a small place. We managed to attract engineers from all over the world. We even have a couple from US moving to Denmark to work for us. So I think that was differentiator for us to do that. So today still we have on the core technologies we're doing, like iOS, Android, front ends, a couple of backend languages, we have a really solid pipeline of people which wants to work for us. So that's a very good position to be in.
Yeah, I like that. I like the idea of taking over, you know, related but abandoned GitHub projects, because that happens a lot. There's like projects you depend on and you go check them and you're like, what happened to the two people maintaining this?
Exactly, yeah. I think the iOS team, they used like a caching library for a while, and then suddenly it was just completely abandoned. So they kind of asked if they could take over and maintain it. So I think that was a fine example of that, that you don't need to, and it doesn't make sense to make a new caching library, right? There's probably already 50 of them.
So how many people are there at the company?
So the entire company is 1,300 people. 800 of them are in the engineering department.
So, like, how do you, as a leader of these 800 engineers, like, how do you maintain a relationship with them?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, yeah, I actually got it this morning from my sister as well, and I said I write them good morning every day, all of them. Obviously, no, that's not possible. But
you just use the at here on Slack. You're like at here, good morning, dude. That's what, yeah, I do. My team's five people big, and I do that.
that's a good start. Yeah. So of course we're structured in various ways. So as I said earlier, like I'm traveling quite a lot. So I'm out visiting the offices at least like 1 or 2 times a month. I'm on a business trip. And some of them are long distance to either US or to Asia. Next week I'm going to Vietnam, where we have two development companies in Da Nang and Hanoi. Where it's like 100 and 250 engineers in each. So that's part of it. The other part is like spending time with the middle management. So we structured in like we call it management structure, where it's like each of the offices, they will have like tech director and there will be some teams below them. And then we also have a practice structure, which is different technologies. So in that sense, like that's why you like I spend a lot of time in backend and architecture the last couple of years and have still have a lot of knowledge I can share there. So I help on projects now and then when I can see them looking for solutions in Slack and things like that, you can step in. And when you're out visiting the offices, I tend to jump into some, like even stand-ups and projects or client meetings and things like that. So that's a part of it. But I think the trick is it's not you who has to do it. You need to build a structure which is doing it.
I like what you mentioned about jumping in, because it's an art form in the sense that you can't micromanage. But when you have everyone having a conversation in a channel and you start to watch that conversation mature, and then you're like, oh, they're going down a path of making a decision on this. And I've made that decision before. And it wasn't clear to me when I was making that decision. But if you go left, you're completely screwed.
Yeah, that's right? That's a good chance, unless they're smarter than you when they implement it. But
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But that sense of like, do I chime in? do I let them learn this, or have I learned this lesson so many times it's becoming like almost factual? So that's a hard thing to do.
Yes, of course. It's a case by case, but also I think it's very important what you just mentioned, that do you want to let them learn the lesson, or do you want to pull someone aside and kind of sell that person it so they can bring it into the team so it didn't come from you? So very often on the bigger projects, we structure ourselves in a way we have a type of role called a solution architect, which are kind of doing the drawings and tech leading the project and making sure that we have alignment between iOS and Android and everyone is using the APIs the correct way and things like that. So that's normally the ones you would speak to and say, hey, I tried this a couple of times and this is actually scaling really badly in these situations. Have you thought about that?
So it's like aligning your different tool sets. First of all, do you even try to align your toolkits across the entire globe, all these 800 people?
Yes, a lot.
How? Like, how do you do that? Must be crazy hard.
Yeah, so across everyone at the moment, is that's also new for me to get that rolled out into APAC as well. But like in Notes, in the EMEA branch, we have development offices in 8 different locations. So that was what I mentioned with the practice structure we had. So we have, like, for example, iOS development is a big core like service we have. The iOS developers across the different offices, they have like a practice structure together where they are like forming a community and aligning on how to do things. There will be put one in charge, we call him head of. So there'll be a head of iOS, which are responsible for this community. But really, the most important thing is that they see it as a community and make sure that everyone can contribute and come up with ideas. But we, end of day, we discuss it and make a decision, and this is what we go forward with. Of course, you can have a couple of experiments. Should we try to do this? Should we try to do that before we roll it out for everyone? But having some kind of structure, it's not really structure. I think what I normally call is like, it's a toolkit, like, how do we attack a project? Like, what tools are we using, when and why? What architecture works for what kind of projects? Those kind of things. So it's something we spend quite a lot of time on aligning over the last many years, and it gives us a lot of flexibility. First of all, because people will be able to jump in and out of projects easier, but it also gives us the ability to move in the same direction as a team, even though we are spread across a lot of offices. So we're assisting each other with the same problems and moving the team forward. That's what we have seen. And I think we're really happy with it. And I think you mentioned earlier, like, it's not because it should be micromanagement in any way. We want to hire great people so you don't have to micromanage them.
Yeah, and I like how you create communities within the company with that, like, iOS lead. That's really great. It's almost like you could be on a plane, you could be reading a book on iOS, and you could find that author, and you have the resources, because you guys are a larger company, to like go track down that person and say, hey, you know, come join us. Have you ever gotten to hire any of your mentors?
So I think we, within the communities and the ones which are speaking at the communities and coming to the conference and that, yes, very often they actually come apply for a job now and then we make sure we make room for them.
That's smart. So what does your day-to-day look like right now?
So my day-to-day is very often a lot of meetings, both with my own teams and like the different head-ups in the technology sectors. Spend some time with them and making sure that I agree with the direction we want to go. But it's also client meetings. I really enjoy client meetings because that's where we can see if our strategy actually works and you can kind of feel it on your own hand. See if the technologies we are pushing for, the ways of doing it, is still what they want. Also, like the engagement model, like how do we do and how do we staff projects, and are we working at our own office? Are we outplacing them at the clients? All these kind of things. So that's a very important thing for me.
When you put people on site, right, at a client's office, how do you keep them connected to your ecosystem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so part of our engagement model is that we don't outplace people on projects, just let them be in a client's office for 6 months. We simply don't think it's efficient. We know a lot of our competitors are doing this. We don't do the other thing either, where we say we are only working from our own office. So we try to do some co-locating with the client when it makes sense, when they have time for it and we have time for it. Or you schedule it in every 2 weeks, you get together a couple of days. And then other time, we feel we are much more efficient at our own office, where we can zone in into the project, but also there will be a lot of colleagues doing the same technology. For example, it could be iOS again, where you can get sparing. But that would be harder if you were sitting somewhere else.
Working near each other is definitely useful. There's like a different level of collaboration that can come from that. You build a relationship, the human things kick in a little bit more. So I'm curious to know about, you get to meet all these people, you get to meet lots of clients, you get to work with, you know, hundreds of amazing technologists. What sort of habits do you value, or what traits do you value in individuals?
Yeah, so in the technology side, I think the thing I admire most, and also the thing I spend most time on getting to that point to figure out that that's actually the most important thing, that's the collaboration part, like being a team player, understanding your colleagues, also understanding that people are different. So when you get to this person, you need to do it a little different when you get to this person. So that part, like I think you also touched upon it in a couple of other of your podcasts, is like, we used to call it soft skills, like how do you communicate, how do you team play, do you manage to get people involved around you, are you proactive at communicating when you're behind, things like that. That's where most in the technology sector today are struggling most. Of course, you need to have some baseline in the technology and development. Otherwise, it will be very hard to have you on the team because, you need to learn a lot still. But that, in those other aspects, that's where I admire the most.
Yeah, it's funny because for me, at least, I got good at technology and computers and engineering younger. And the way I did that was by isolating myself, by like not interacting with people. I would just... at school, all I could do is think about video games and writing code. And when I'd get home, all I would do is video games and writing code. And that loop just played out. Like I had one or two acquaintances, but learning to interact with other people was just such a, for most people, it's not this like big point in time where you do that. They just gradually develop these skills. But for me, it was like, okay, now I want to go outside and interact with people. I have to go start learning how to do that. And so that journey was like a pretty big one for me.
Yeah, I guess it is from a lot of people. It was a little bit different for me. I came very late into computer science. I think I wrote my first line of code at university. I was always really good at math and physics and stuff like that. And very social and like in school and high school. So I was kind of not a classic match to the technology university. So I spent minimum time at the university, and as soon as I could get off, I went back to my flat I had with a good friend and played a lot of video games and went out on the weekends and things like that. And then it was very late that I got like really pulled into the coding, where I got really, I would say, like, where I spent a lot of time on it. That was when I like discovered mobile applications. I had a course at university where we did like Java applications for Nokia phones, and then we did like for the first Nokia like OS Lumia, if you remember that one. And then Android came around, like Android 1.5 or something like that, in 2010, and I jumped on that. And then you got those, like you got the same feelings that you could build something in the evening and you could really see your progress from day to day, and you could release and install on all these things. So I like at that point, that's why I shifted over and start spending much more time on writing code and playing computer games. I did that for quite some years and got really, really good at it.
Elon Musk is having an AI party at his house for his autonomous driving team. Have you heard about that?
No.
Oh, it's all the rage this week. I just follow him. But he's having a party at his house. And I was curious, have you guys ever done any autonomous vehicle technology?
No, not ourselves. We were talking with a couple of startups on helping them build the applications, but never anything serious.
I think that's going to be like, I think the autonomous driving is just going to explode and go really, really fast over the next 4 or 5 years. What do you think?
I think the technology is close there. I think it's the human factor right now which needs to be taken into account, that we need to like pick this up and also create laws around it and accept. I think that's it. And then I don't know, maybe there will be some kind of like traffic regulations and things like that which needs to be adjusted a little bit down the line, but it's definitely going there. But I think if you said the same thing 5 years ago, people would also say 2020, it's going to be a lot of self-driving cars, right? And we're not there.
But we're there some. There's more than 5 years ago.
Yeah, of course. But like, I think I would have been surprised if it was this little at this point 5 years ago.
That's true. Yeah. But I think it'll just happen like really fast. And I've also been seeing it like at like campuses. I believe there's like an autonomous bus at like Facebook or on the Google campuses. So just because they're not like in the streets for everyday people, like didn't Uber just do a delivery, an autonomous semi truck delivery?
Yeah, like that. And I think that those buses they are coming. Like I think that they are coming to Copenhagen next year as well.
Oh,
be some places where they will be driving around. But I think like imagine the amount of vehicles on the road today and all that needs to be replaced, or there will be some kind of transition period where you both have human people, a human driving while computers are driving. That's going to be interesting, right?
Yeah. When I was in California, they have like the lane for carpooling, and like most of the people are not in the carpooling lane. And so you can drive in that lane if you have multiple people in the car, but you can also go in it if you have an electric vehicle. And so what they're doing is they're incentivizing people to essentially like, you want to use that lane, have an electric vehicle. And then eventually what I think will happen is like two lanes, three lanes. And then like, then at one day there will only be one lane for all the mechanical or the gasoline human driving cars. And like they have to all drive in that one lane, and the other eight lanes are for all the autonomous and electric vehicles. I think that's how like it'll transition on the public roads.
Yeah. And on the freeways that might work, but like in the older cities where you have a fixed amount of roads at this point, you need to have them together, right? So like in the Nordics, we've done a lot for electric cars as well. Like, so I don't know if you know, but in Denmark, for example, we have a really high tax on cars. But if you buy a full electric car, there's almost no tax. And from this year on, you will be able to park freely in Copenhagen if you have an electric car. So they're kind of pushing a lot for it. And I know they did the same in Norway. So that's how we push it here. So there's a lot of like Teslas and electric cars driving around here.
So as we start to wrap up, I'm going to give you a hypothetical situation.
Okay.
You might have some knowledge of this, but let's pretend that we both get invited to Elon Musk AI party for autonomous vehicles, right? And we go there and Elon Musk taps you on the shoulder and he takes you into this back room and he's got a time machine. And you go into that time machine and you get to go back to your past self right when you started at Nodes. What advice would you give to yourself then?
Yeah, it's a good question, because like a lot of the errors you did took you to here, right? But I think for a long time, as we talked about previously, I was really zoned into technology and just spent a lot of time in projects all the time. But at the same time, we were building up a company and building a tech department. So it was very late I discovered that if you invest much more time with your employees, all the way from recruitment to onboarding to training, and keep involving, that's coming back many times. So spend more time on like people, I think. And then also when you're building up a company, you are most likely extremely motivated and ambitious, and you cannot expect that the people you hire will be the same. You need to build a company where there's room for the everyday guy as well. Otherwise, you're going to be running really, really fast yourself, and you're not going to be able to do it unless you work double shifts or more or less. So I think that would be some advice I would give myself, and then maybe get more offline. Don't spend that much time on the computers. But I don't think I would have listened to that. I am still very passionate and like really enjoy it. That's also like a big hobby of mine when I'm like on vacation or something like that, is to, if I have time to do programming, and I have a lot of side projects I'm working on, because that was what got me into this business in the start. Even though I don't have that much time to do it today during the office hours, it's still a big hobby.
I love it. I love that you said that you might not listen to yourself, because me too, right? I might be like, nah, and then I'd probably come around after a little bit, but no, that is great. Dude, this is awesome. Casper, we did it, my friend. We made a podcast. How do you feel?
That was fun. Great. Yeah. Great meeting you as well.
Yeah. And I really liked that last piece of advice. I was like, it was very unique and it was really true.
Which one, about the spending more time on recruitment or?
Yeah, and with your people. And it really resonated with me. And then making sure that while you're driven and you're doing the startup, you have to make room for the everyday person. Like, that's important too. Like, you have to have those people that will do it. Yeah.
Exactly. I was very like tough on a lot of people in the beginning because I didn't understand why they were not as motivated as me. And of course that makes sense. They don't have any shares in the company. They're not like coming in here to build up a company. They're coming here to do a job and get paid and get home with the family, right?
And there's also some benefit to having them like not stressed and just like, I'm going to come in and I'm going to do this one piece really well. And then I'm going to go home. And if you get people that have a high level of quality that just get in that pattern of just coming in and doing something really well, then you end up, it compounds. And yeah, you
get. Like the thing about the quality, like is when I ask some of the clients I've worked with the last couple of years, that's very much why they still work with us, is that we really like believe in quality. And for a lot of the big companies, it's like, it's quality first time is just so important. And they're not used to full agile, where you say, we will launch our MVP and then we do 15 iterations and then we'll be okay. They have a really hard time getting that. So getting in with good quality first time is very important.
That's exciting. All right, man. Thank you so much for hanging out with me today. And then I'll have Jake and Chloe let you know when we release everything.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a wonderful evening. Thanks, bud.
Bye.
Bye.